For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Over these next 2 weeks, I want us to think about learning, the opportunity to learn about important matters that's been given to us through the release of this book and movie, because the Da Vinci Code raises important questions about Jesus and about the Bible, the New Testament specifically, and about the church. And so we welcome the opportunity to dialogue about these issues with the confidence that the real Jesus is not afraid of our questions. Now, before we dive into the main theme that I want to discuss this morning, I want to make just a couple of general observations about this phenomenon known as the Da Vinci Code. First of all, of course, this is a well-written novel. And I, for one, couldn't stop reading it once I started reading it a little over 2 years ago. I mean, in the bathroom and everything for about a day and a half, I just read. It's a great page-turner. It's a great murder mystery. And, of course, the movie's out just recently. I went and saw the movie last week, and this is my opinion. I didn't think the movie really lived up to the book, as is so often the case. It was a little long, and the scenes themselves moved kind of slowly, in my opinion, but be that as it may. You know, this is a novel, and it's a novel with an agenda, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that at all. Lots of novels have an agenda. Many novels, in fact, many of the most influential novels in English history, the novels are famous because they've had a goal not just to entertain, but to inform and to persuade. You know, one of the most influential novels of this sort was written by Harriet Beecher Stowe in the 1850s, I believe, entitled Uncle Tom's Cabin. And it was a fictional novel which, through that medium, sought to inform the American public about the evils of slavery and to persuade people to stand against the institution of slavery. And many historians credit that novel as one of the main influences that led to the eventual abolition of slavery. And this novel is upfront about its agenda, and that's good. Sort of upfront, not entirely, but sort of. What is the agenda of the Da Vinci Code? These are my words, but I think they're a fair summary. The agenda, the message of the movie is that you've been lied to about Jesus. That certain powerful people long ago changed the story about Jesus in order to consolidate their power, in this case political power. And that others have perpetuated this deception for their own selfish agendas. That's the essence of the message or the agenda that this novel tries to persuade us about. And I'll unpack that a little bit more. But I think that this message really resonates with the mood of our culture for a number of reasons. There is in our culture today a very deep-seated suspicion toward institutions of power, powerful institutions. And there's a lot of historical reasons for that. There is in our culture today a deep-seated suspicion of powerful religious institutions, including powerful Christian religious institutions. There are people whose lives have been hurt deeply by the church, people who have been abused by people who stand for the leadership of the institutional church. And so there's a sentiment and a mood here that the message of this novel really resonates with. And so that's, I think, part of the reason for its popularity. And so the main poster says, "Will you be one to seek the truth? That you've been lied to, and so seek the truth, the real truth about Jesus." And I think that sentiment is very noble as well. There is a sort of confusing feature to this novel, and that is that it's both fictional and claims also to be factual. Sometimes it's not real clear. I mean, some people are like, what's all the hubbub about? After all, this book is sold in the fiction section of the bookstore. It's a fictional novel. Why are people so up in arms about what it's saying? Well, the reason for that, as I've said, is that the novel, while the plot line and the events of the novel clearly are fictional, there's a message that claims to be factual that is delivered from the very beginning. You get this on the first page, in which Dan Brown says, all descriptions of artwork, architecture, documents, and secret rituals in this novel are accurate. So these things are facts. And that's what you get as you begin into the novel. It's also the fact that the book's scholars, Sir Teabing and Robert Langdon, are presented as authoritative, and their opinions are presented very strongly as factual. And so that kind of overlays the factual tone of their argument. And then, of course, there's the fact that Dan Brown has stated in public that he really believes that the argument in the Da Vinci Code is true, that this is what's true about Jesus. So there's this kind of confusion, well, which is it, fact or fiction or both, that I think kind of stirs the pot and stirs the controversy and stirs the sales and stirs the interest. And that's just, it is what it is. Now, what I want to do this morning is address what I think is the main issue raised by this book and this movie and respond to it. The assertion on which everything else really depends and flows from is the assertion that he makes about the four Gospels of the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And let me read to you the two really key quotes from the book itself that gives us the Da Vinci Code's opinion about this issue. The first is from Teabing, the scholar. He says, the Bible is a product of man, my dear, speaking to Sophie, not of God. Man created it as a historical record of tumultuous times, and it has evolved through countless translations, additions, and revisions. History has never had a definitive version of the book. More than 80 Gospels were considered for the New Testament, and yet only a relative few were chosen for inclusion, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John among them. And so you get this impression of just a free-for-all, 80 different versions of Jesus going back to the very beginning, somehow, somewhere down the line, a decision to opt for four of them. And then just a couple of pages later, Robert Langdon supplies the reason for the selection of the four books that wound up in the Bible. Those who chose the original history of Christ, he says, were the world's first heretic. A heretic is a false teacher, a deceiver. Because the Emperor Constantine in 325 roughly AD, because Constantine upgraded Jesus' status almost four centuries after his death, thousands of documents already existed that chronicled his life as a mere mortal man. In order to rewrite the history books, Constantine knew that he would need a bold stroke. From this sprang the most profound moment in Christian history. Constantine commissioned and financed a new Bible, which omitted those Gospels that spoke of Christ's human traits and embellished those Gospels that made him godlike. And so this also resonates deeply with the postmodern sentiments of our culture, that people in power tend to use their power to consolidate themselves and to marginalize others. And that there's a phrase that you may have heard, that history is written by the winners. That the people in power rewrite history to consolidate their power and to marginalize other voices. And there's a lot of truth in that historically. And so I think these two quotes kind of capture the real issue that's causing the controversy and the hubbub. And so to me, you know, the questions that we ought to be asking are things like this. Is it true that over 80 other gospels that described different Jesuses, is it true that they were circulating from the very beginning of the church? Is it true that there was no consensus about which gospels were authentic until 300 years after Jesus was here? And is it true that the four gospels became the official accounts about Jesus, not because they were accurate, but because they supported the agenda of Constantine and a certain segment of the church? Those are the substantive questions that we deserve informed answers about. So what I want to try to do for the bulk of our time here this morning is to respond to these questions. I'm not a scholar. I mean, I've had some formal education in these areas, the early church as well as the Bible, but I'm not a scholar, and I think most of you aren't scholars. And I'm a little concerned that even as I've tried to distill what I think are the important issues on this matter, I'm afraid that I don't want you walking out of here feeling like you were made to drink from a fire hose. I don't want you to be overwhelmed with information. And in a little bit, I'm going to give you a couple of other places that you can get more information on this from at your own leisure. I want to share with you six facts concerning the four New Testament Gospels that are very, very relevant to this whole issue raised by the Da Vinci Code. Fact number one, the four New Testament Gospels are the only first century written accounts about Jesus. And you know, even 150 years ago, there were scholars that said, oh no, most of the Gospels were probably written 200 AD or whatever. I don't know of any serious biblical scholar, Christian or not, who would disagree with this conclusion today, that all four of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, were written before the end of the first century. Mark being first, probably written between 50 and 60 AD. Matthew and Luke being written probably by the early 60s AD. John being written by probably between 80 and 90 AD. There's no serious dispute about this, and that they're the only written accounts about Jesus that are first century. Well, why is this important? Well, because anytime you're trying to study a historical event or a person, you want to go for the earliest written sources. Why do you want to find those? Because the closer in proximity that the earliest sources are to the person or the event, the more reliable that information is going to tend to be. It's just common sense. These are the earliest ones. We have the writings of very early church leaders, we're talking about before the first century ended, that quote each of these Gospels. We have a fragment of John's Gospel, which is the last one written, a fragment that's been found in Egypt and dated reliably to about 120, 115 AD. And that's pretty amazing, because that means that by 115, 120 AD, John's Gospel was not only copied, but distributed to hundreds of miles away from where he wrote it. And so there's no real controversy about this. And that's important, because conversely, all the other Gospels, and depending upon how loosely you use that term, we're talking not about 80 plus Gospels. We're talking about somewhere between 20 and 27 other Gospels. The earliest of those was written no earlier than the mid-second century. The so-called Gospel of Thomas and Valentinus's The Gospel of Truth were both written at the earliest about 150 AD. And then these Gospels come after that, right on up into the early Middle Ages. That's a significant fact in terms of where are we going to go to get a reliable portrait of the real Jesus. Fact number two, these accounts are eyewitness narrative accounts. And both terms, eyewitness and narrative, are important when we're searching for an accurate portrait of a past person or event. These accounts are narrative in the sense that they lodge Jesus in a historical framework where they talk about when he was born and where he went and connect him to other known historical places and people. They also bear the clear marks of an eyewitness account. And that's very important. Because again, when you're trying to do history, when you're trying to learn about some past event, the very best sources are eyewitness sources. And unless the eyewitness sources discredit themselves, the burden lies on us why we wouldn't take their testimony very, very seriously. And so you see almost incidental details in these four Gospels that you do not see in the other Gospels that reveal their eyewitness tone. For example, in Mark 6, Mark talks about the feeding of the 5,000. And Mark, who's writing Peter's memoirs, we're told, makes reference to the fact that Jesus had them sit down on the green grass. Well, grass is always green, right? Well, no, if you know Palestine, then you know grass is only green for a relatively short time in the spring of the year. And he just happens to remember that, write that down, right? Because that's stuck in his memory. How about at the end of John's gospel, when he talks about how Jesus had them put down their nets? John, who was a fisherman by trade, he says, you know, we caught 153 fish when he told us to put our nets down. And, he says, the nets didn't break. Now, that's the kind of detail. People are like, well, what's it mean, 153? What's the symbolic code? It means there were a lot of fish. And a fisherman who lives by his trade counts the fish. And the fact that they don't have to mend the nets after a huge catch, that's huge. That's exactly the kind of thing that you'd expect an eyewitness fisherman to write down. They make reference to people's emotional reaction to events. For example, Luke, who tells us that he wrote his gospel by interviewing eyewitnesses of the events. And he says, I'm writing this account to you, Theophilus, who was a Roman official, he says, so that you may know the exact truth about these things. One of the things that Luke describes is Jesus's birth and his early childhood. And at the end of that section, he says, you know, Mary continued to ponder these things and she treasured these things in her heart. He's not only telling us what happened, he's telling us how Mary felt when she thought about them. Where'd he get that from? From interviewing Mary. These little incidental details. John makes reference in John 1 to the fact that baptisms were taking place in Bethany beyond the Jordan. I think that's John 1:28. It's a little detail. Bethany beyond the Jordan. In other words, he's saying not the Bethany close to Jerusalem. Well, that's a little incidental detail, and for many, then Bethany beyond the Jordan got lost to history to the point where 100 years ago, Bible skeptics were pointing to that to prove that John wasn't written by the disciple, because there never was a Bethany beyond the Jordan until, of course, archaeologists excavated Bethany beyond the Jordan. These little details, historical narrative, historical eyewitness narrative. It's the best possible kind of information that you can get when you're trying to reconstruct a historical event or a person. By contrast, most of the other gospels either have no narrative at all. For example, the Gospel of Thomas is really not a gospel, because gospel means a good news, a good report. It's 114 completely unconnected alleged sayings by Jesus. We'll look at some of those next week. But there's no narrative. There's no interface with history. Or where there is a narrative, it's not historical narrative that talks about places and events and times, but really much more like a mythical story. Let me give you an example. This comes from the infancy gospel of Thomas. That does not mean that this is something that Thomas wrote when he was an infant. It purports to be about the disciple Thomas writing about Jesus's young childhood. And it dates from the mid-third century, 250 AD, thereabouts. Here's an example of what I'm talking about with in terms of a narrative, but not a historical narrative. It says the son of Annas the scribe was standing there with Joseph, his father, and he took a willow branch and he let the waters out which Jesus had collected. He'd created a little dam by a creek, playing in the pool. Jesus, seeing what was done, was angry and said to the man, "Oh, wicked, impious, and foolish one. What harm did the pool and the waters do to you? Behold, even now you will be dried up like a tree, and you won't bring forth either leaves or root or fruit." And right away, that man was withered up. Jesus departed and went to Joseph's house. But the parents of the boy that had been withered took him up and, bewailing his youth, brought him to Joseph. And so Joseph called Jesus and admonished him, saying, "Why do you do such things? Make these people suffer and hate us and persecute us." Jesus said to Joseph, "I know that these words of yours are not your own. Nevertheless, for your sake, I'll be silent, but they shall bear their punishment." And straightway, those parents that accused him were struck blind. And after that, Jesus was passing through the village, and a boy ran up against him and struck his shoulder. Jesus was angry and said to him, "You shall not go back the way you came." And immediately he fell down dead. So, I mean, this is like, you know, the adventures of Super Brat. That's what this is like. And it's written centuries later when there came to be a lot of fascination about what was Jesus like as a kid. And it's written as a mythical story. Nothing. In fact, I would just say this. One of the best things you can do if you're interested about this issue is to read the New Testament Gospels and then read these other Gospels. That's one of the best things you can do in terms of getting the sense of the difference between serious historical narrative and the other. Third, these four Gospels report what I call history in the raw. They're not propaganda. When you're writing propaganda, then you sanitize the history. You exclude everything that doesn't help you make your case. And one thing you'll notice if you read through the four Gospels is that, you know, they're very upfront about what their purpose is. We'll talk about that in a moment. But they keep including things that don't help them make their case. I mean, think about one example of this that you all know about Peter. What a blockhead. Here's a guy who's a leader of the early Christian movement, and yet it's right in there all through. What a blockhead he is. Rebuking Jesus for his notion that he has to go to Jerusalem and be crucified. Denying him three times, you know, on the night when he was in his greatest need. The sort of stuff that you just don't include if you're writing a sanitized history. The disciples' complete unwillingness to believe that Jesus had been raised from the dead initially. And so there's things like that that you wouldn't include if you were writing propaganda, because it casts you in an unfavorable light. Or how about reporting to other things that don't help their case? How about the fact that they all tell us that the first witnesses to Jesus's empty tomb were women? Look, we're talking about a culture in which women weren't even allowed to give testimony in a court. Their women's testimony was regarded as worthless. And so you're trying to make your case about Jesus being raised from the dead. And so you put front and center each time, well, the first people that saw the empty tomb, the first people who saw him alive were women. Wouldn't you at least exclude that part and just include the male witnesses? Why do they keep putting in details and information about themselves that don't help them make their case? Well, the best explanation is because they really were committed to telling the whole truth. And that's what happened. So they write history in the raw. Fact number four. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John received no financial or political advantage for their testimony. This is actually worded wrongly. It should be worded much more strongly. It should be read, they suffered incredible disadvantage for writing their histories. Now, the point is this. In the Da Vinci Code, of course, it's suggested that the reason why Constantine chose these gospels was his own political advantage. They gave the version of Jesus that he judged would help him consolidate his power. And that the reason why a certain segment of the church signed off on this after Constantine rigged the vote was because it helped them gain power in the early church. Now, whether or not that's the case is another issue. And I think the answer to that question is a little bit more complicated. But the point is, it's completely irrelevant. What's relevant is what these men had to gain by writing down their witness about what they saw and heard from Jesus. And no one disputes the fact that they gained nothing financially or politically by writing down their testimony. Because what they gained, and this is not disputed, was poverty and suffering and death. Because when they spoke and when they recorded their witness about Jesus before they died, Christianity was severely persecuted both by the Jewish nation, which had rejected the claim that Jesus was their promised Messiah, and was severely persecuted by the Roman Empire, which rejected Christianity because it insisted that Jesus, not Caesar, is Lord. So what they got for their testimony was persecution. And all 12 of Jesus' disciples, with the possible exception of John, suffered martyrdom. Why? Because they wouldn't retract their claims about what Jesus said, what he did, and who he claimed to be. And so this is a strong evidence for the credibility of their account, when they are willing to stand by their account, when they stand to lose everything, including their lives. Look, people die all the time for lies. How many German young men died tragically for Nazi ideology, which was a lie, a monstrous lie? But you know, people don't die for what they know is a lie. People sometimes die for lies that they think are true. But people don't voluntarily lay down their lives for what they know is not true, which is what we'd have to say about these folks. I don't know where to put this point, so I'm just sticking it in here. The fact that these Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John have an agenda does not impeach the factuality of their report. Now look, I'm bringing this up because, again, in our culture today, people, you often hear it said, well, you know, okay, yeah, they're writing something about an account of history, but they're trying to persuade people of something. So we can't trust what they're saying. In other words, there's the presumption that it's propaganda. This came up, I noticed this a couple of years ago during the Passion, when it came out. And a clergyman here in town said, you know, the Gospels are evangelistic documents. They're documents seeking to persuade people that Jesus is the Messiah. But they're not history. Because, you know, history makes no attempt to persuade. Well, that's just ludicrous. Of course history, historical accounts, most historical accounts are written for a purpose. Very few people until very recently had the luxury to sit around and just write about the past for the sake of writing about the past. The fact that people are writing history for a purpose doesn't in itself call into question what they're writing, whether what they're writing is true or not. Sometimes it's what happened to them, what they witnessed, that makes them so committed to writing about it. Here's what Craig Blomberg says, a New Testament scholar. He says, simply because a writer is passionately committed to promoting a particular cause does not at all mean that he or she will falsify the facts. This is our postmodern suspicion, because people often do this. Often such a person will work all the harder to tell the story straight. After all, often the truthfulness of something is what produced the personal commitment in the first place. How many of you have read Elie Wiesel's book, Night? A few. You ought to. Elie Wiesel lived through the Holocaust. Elie Wiesel dedicated the rest of his life to preserving the memory and the historical chronicling of the Holocaust. Did he do that as a detached historical scholar? No, he did it because he had an agenda. You know what his agenda is? I want to document the Holocaust so that it never happens again. I want to know how many people in this room, this city, this nation are willing to say that we can't trust any Jewish historian's account of the Holocaust because they've got an agenda. That's not the issue. The issue is, what is the evidence that the historical accounts are factual and truthful? And you have to go at that through the things that I'm bringing up here this morning. Fact number five. The accounts of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John have been accurately transmitted. I think this is one of the most insidious things, frankly, about the book and the movie. And the movie has a great little flashback to the Council of Nicaea. And there's this big table and all these piles of gospels on it. And, you know, hundreds of church leaders shouting at each other. It's pandemonium. And these three or four poor scribes that are sitting there like, what do I do now? And you know, you get that impression that the New Testament canon or the New Testament list of books was agreed upon, that it was a crapshoot. That there are all these books, and someone finally said, we got to make a decision. So everyone brings their wheelbarrows of books, you know, and they vote, or in this case, the view is that Constantine rigged the vote. You know, that picture it's scandalous. Every serious bit of historical information we have tells us the same thing, which is that these accounts were preserved accurately because we have so many copies of the New Testament documents going back so early between the time that they were written and our first copies. And as I'll show you in a moment, these four alone were recognized from the beginning of the early church as authoritative and authentic descriptions of Jesus. First, the transmission. This is the conclusion of a textual critic scholar, Sir Frederick Kenyon. He says the interval between the dates of original composition of the New Testament and the earliest extant evidence, that is, the interval of time between when we have our first copies and when they were written, is so small as to be, in fact, negligible. And the last foundation for any doubt that the scriptures have come down to us substantially as they were written has now been removed. Both the authenticity and the general integrity of these books of the New Testament may be regarded as finally established. We have over 5,000 copies of the New Testament, ancient, going back to within about 200 years of their original composition. You say, big deal. That's 200 years. Listen, when you look at the writings of Plato or other Greek and Roman historians and authors, and we no one doubts that we have today an accurate transmission of what they originally wrote, when normally we have 3, 4, 5 ancient copies of what they wrote. And normally those ancient copies are 1,000 years after these people wrote what they wrote. In other words, that's considered great transmission. The New Testament, 5,000 within a couple of hundred years of the original composition. And I want to add, by way of contrast, that when it comes to the other so-called Gospels, there are far fewer copies. The time between their original composition and the first copy is often quite a bit longer. And in many cases, we have only fragmentary portions of those Gospels. I guess one example of that would be the so-called Gospel of Philip, because that's the one that has the account of Jesus' kissing Mary Magdalene on the mouth often. We'll probably get into that a little bit next week. Even that passage in the Gospel of Philip, which we don't have the whole thing, even that passage is a fragment with missing words and phrases. So we know that when we read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, we're reading with 99% certainty exactly what they wrote, only translated into our languages. That's unparalleled in any history, any religion. And secondly, connected to this, as I said, we have about as much evidence as it's possible to get that it was not a crapshoot, that 300 years later they had a vote that was rigged by Constantine, but that as far back as we can go, which is right back into the late first century, these four books were always regarded as the authentic account of Jesus. We have Clement of Rome, who's an early church leader, who wrote in 96-97 AD, who quotes all four of these books as the inspired account of Jesus. And every church leader from the very early church forward, of whom we have dozens of records, there's just a continuous voice on their part. These are the ones. You know why they're so insistent to name these? And they name and exclude others beginning about 150 AD. Do you know why? Because it is true that almost immediately counterfeit versions of Jesus did begin to circulate. People began to remake Jesus in their own image. People began to remake Jesus to exemplify their own philosophy. And we're going to talk about this next week. Jesus himself predicted that that would happen. And ironically, it's because of the proliferation of those counterfeit versions of Jesus that the early Christians were so careful to record, because they knew Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, these are the ones that tell the truth about Jesus. Here's what M.A. Smith, a historian, I read this years ago in college, and I went back and found it because it's so timely. He says, discussions over the canon, or the accepted books of the New Testament, were mainly concerned with ruling out the outsiders who were trying to creep in. Sometimes a picture is painted that of a group of clerics confronted by a heap of books, arbitrarily selecting just a few and declaring these alone to be canonical. Well, that's the Da Vinci Code position. Only it's not arbitrary, it's Constantine's power. Such a view is a travesty of the truth. The question was largely one of making official what was already general practice. No real questions were ever raised about the four Gospels. Okay, here's the point that I'm trying to make, just to spit it out to you. And I'm understating this, okay? We can have solid historical confidence that the four New Testament Gospels portrait of Jesus is an authentic portrait. That's understated. I was tempted to say, but I won't say, so I'll tell you what I'm not going to, what I was going to say, but don't going to say. I was tempted to say that we can be more certain that their portrait of Jesus is authentic than we can about virtually any other ancient historical figure. And I think that's true with one exception. Here's what Vermes and Flusser, who are non-Christian historians, they're specialists of ancient Judaism. What they say is, we know more about Jesus, and because of the four canonical Gospels, and Acts, and Paul, we know more about Jesus than about almost any other first century Jew. There is one other first century Jew that we know more about than Jesus. Do you know who it is? Paul. And we know more about Paul because we have 13 letters by Paul, which is a greater number of documents. And we have Luke's Acts of the Apostles, which give us a lot of information about Paul. We know more about Paul than we know about Jesus. And the only real reason we know so much about Paul is because of Jesus. But it's just a fact that you can have historical confidence that the Jesus in the New Testament Gospels is an authentic portrait. And so, you know, people have the freedom to choose what they're going to do with Jesus. I think one of the things that Jesus died for was to give us the liberty to make our choice about him. And Christians should never jam this down people's throats or try to compel people to believe what we believe about Jesus. God wants you to choose what you will, but you at least deserve to know what you're choosing. And it's at best not helpful and at worst dishonest to create this picture that, you know, there was no clear version of who Jesus was from the very beginning and it was all a political power play. I mean, that's just not honest. And it's just not honest. Now, if you want more information on this, I'd recommend these sources. Lee Strobel was an investigative reporter for the Chicago Tribune, and see, so he knows, you know, he knows how to go at issues investigatively. And his little book with Gary Poole called Exploring the Da Vinci Code is a pretty good and readable wealth of information about this subject. I also recommend his website, leestrobel.com, because there, one thing that you have is you have 3 to 7 minute video clips of different scholars responding to dozens of different questions related to the issues raised by the Da Vinci Code. I hope I don't regret saying this. I think people like that because when they look at a video clip, they feel somehow that it's more real than when they read a book. And of course, that's not necessarily true, but I do trust the integrity of his research, and he's making it accessible to you in bite-sized chunks that you can take in and consider. All right, I have one more thing that I'd like to share with you. That is, I want to just talk for a couple of minutes about this question. How come Christians are so passionate about this issue? Because there is real passion associated with these issues that the Da Vinci Code has raised. And I want to say at the outset that I'm passionate about it. I also want to say I think that there's a kind of passion here that's wrong and that discredits Jesus. When Christians get nasty and when they vilify people who disagree with them, in my opinion, when they advocate picketing movies or bookstores because they sell the Da Vinci Code, I think that that's misplaced, misexpressed passion. But having said that, I feel a real sense of passion about this issue. And I remember reading the book 2 years ago, feeling so conflicted emotionally because part of me was so excited about the plot line that I was just like thrilled. Ah, what's next? And then when I'd get to sections like the quotes that I read to you, I'd get frustrated. And I think my wife even heard me make comments out loud, although I was reading silently. Comments of frustration and, yes, anger at some of the statements that were made because I knew them to be false. But I just want to share a little bit with you on why that is. I wish I could say, you know, it's because I am committed with all of my heart to historical integrity. And I hope that I am committed to that. Because if you know anything about the Bible, one of the things that it's telling us is that the God who really exists has revealed himself through history. He's tied himself to the real world, so history matters. History is important. And that's a unique thing about the Bible compared to all other world religions. But I have to tell you, that's not the reason, but the reason why I'm so passionate. I mean, you know, I'm aware of the fact that there's a controversy that Thomas Jefferson may have had an affair with his slave, Sally Hemings, and that he may have sired a child by her or children, the bloodline of which continues till today. And that's interesting. I have to admit it's interesting. And I've read a couple of magazine articles about that. I've even surfed the web a little bit about it. But I don't have any real passion about that. And I'll tell you why I don't, because the truth about what happened between Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings doesn't personally impact my life and the direction of my life. And I just want to tell you that the passion that I have about this issue has to do with the fact that this Jesus, the Jesus described in the four Gospels, that Jesus has changed my life. And I think that you would find with a lot of Christians who have passion about this, this is the rock bottom issue. I am just so glad that someone told me about this Jesus when they did. And they told me about this Jesus who was not just an enlightened teacher, but who was the Son of God. And who came to live the perfect life that I owe to God, but could not give him. And who came because God loved me to lay his life down as a perfect sacrifice, just like the Old Testament prophet said he would. And that he was raised from the dead so that he was alive still today, and that I could meet him and entrust myself to him. And if I did that, he would change my life. And I want to tell you that this person has changed my life. I mean, I read about the Jesus in the Gospels, and he is an inspiring character in and of itself. Even if he died and stayed dead, his character is so inspiring that I guess that would have some impact. But I have to admit, that's not the main thing that makes me passionate. What makes me passionate is that I've met him. And I look at my life, and I look at the change that took place in my life that I can trace right back to the day when I called out to him and said, if you're really there like they say you are, I want you to forgive me. I want you to come into my life, and I want you to lead me. I can trace back to that decision a change in my life for good that I'm still in awe of 36 years later. I mean, when I think about what that delivered me from, the drug abuse that I was involved in, the pattern of deceit in my relationship, the egotistical orientation of my entire way of life, and I think about what turn my life has taken since then, and the freedom to not have to get high in order to cope with reality. The ability, imperfect though it is, to actually care about other people. The desire, as much as I've been given now, to live in reality and to tell the truth. The purpose that I now have for my life. The hope that I have, not just about what happens when I die, but the hope that I have that no matter what life throws at me, Jesus himself will help me through it, which I've seen him do over and over again. You see, those are the sorts of things that make you passionate about an issue like this. You know, it's sort of like if someone was telling things that were not true about my wife. You know, my life has been changed for good because of my relationship with my wife. And she's not Jesus. And she knows she's not Jesus. And I know that she's not Jesus. And I know that you need to know that she's not Jesus. Okay? And all that proper qualifications. But oh my gosh, I think, what would happen? How much my life has been enriched by knowing my wife. What impact has she had on me for good? And many of you know her, and she's impacted you for good. If someone began to tell things about her that were fundamentally untrue, there would be passion in my heart about that, because her life has impacted mine. Now, you can't all know my wife, because she's just a person. But the amazing thing is that we can all know Jesus personally, because he's the Son of God, and because he raised from the dead, and he is alive and prepared to meet you right now if you call out to him. And that's where the passion comes from. And it comes from, of course, because I want other people to have their lives changed for good, like my life has been changed through meeting Jesus. And that's a good passion to have. It's not a passion that does harm to people. My passion for Jesus and to accurately represent Jesus has done more good in the lives of others than anything else that I've done. I'll tell you that. Because when you love Jesus and when you're committed to following him, he will never lead you to use other people or to deceive other people or to do violence to them in any way. He leads you to sacrificially do good to them. So I want people to know him. If you've never done this, I hope that you'll read one of the four Gospels between now and next week. Read the Gospel of John. Take your pick. We like choices. We American like choices. So God's given us choices. You got four to choose from. Read one of them. You want to know the shortest one? Mark. You want to know the longest one? Luke. You want something in between? Matthew and John. Read one of them next week. I just appeal to you. Call out to God today and say, you know, if this whole thing is true, then I want to know. And then read with an open heart one of those. And come back next week, and we're going to talk next week. We're going to talk more in a focused way about this Jesus, the Jesus that's portrayed in the Da Vinci Code and the Jesus that's portrayed in the documents that are proven reliable. The real Jesus is really cool. He's really cool. And he's someone so unique that I don't think anyone could have invented him. We're going to talk about that next week. Okay, let's pray. Dear Lord, I thank you that you took the initiative toward me and that you are far cooler than I ever thought you could be. And I thank you that your unpredictability has been for good in my life. And I just pray above all else, Lord, that as a result of these 2 weeks that we spend here on this subject, that you'll be really receive the credit and the admiration and the love and the worship that you deserve. And we ask for that in Christ's name. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.